بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. إن الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Brothers and sisters and friends, unfortunately this video is going to be about the crisis that is unfolding in Palestine. I want to raise with you some arguments, some thought experiments, and five key major points to help you reframe the narrative. Because the purpose of this video is to do that, to reframe the narrative. Now, before I get into the arguments and to the five key major points that I want to articulate, I want to raise a few points with you, some preliminary points. Firstly, I do not condone the killing of innocent people. Non-combatants, whether a child, a woman, or a man, must never be targeted. In saying this, the recent conflict in Palestine has brought to light once again the Zionist fallacies, propaganda, tyranny, apartheid, genocide, and oppression. And another purpose for this video is to speak to non-Muslims in particular who are unaware or misinformed about the recent conflict. Now, the mainstream media, unfortunately, have deliberately misframed the conflict, and they have made the oppressed the oppressor and the oppressor the oppressed. And Malcolm X, may God have mercy on him, articulated this very well. He said, "The media is the most powerful entity on earth. They have the power to make the innocent guilty and to make the guilty innocent." He also said, "If you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing." Another point I want to raise is that approximately 2,000 Palestinian children have been killed by Israeli forces since October the 7th. 2,000 Palestinian children. So I want to ask the following question. Is the life of a Palestinian child worth less than the life of any other child? Well, it seems to be the case for many people, because if 2,000 children were murdered by a political entity, by a state, irrespective of the context, there would be international rage, especially if that country was a Western country. And connected to this are two false arguments I really want to quickly just dismiss and to refute. And these arguments are expressed by Zionists and the mainstream media and politicians. And these arguments are as follows. Hamas's actions must be condemned. And they say this and they assert this without condemning what Israel is doing right now. And they also argue Israel has a right to defend itself. Now, with all due respect, these are not valid arguments anymore. And let me explain why. If some people expect to condemn the attacks that occurred on October the 7th, because they were brutal and horrific and around 1,400 people were killed, then it logically follows they must condemn Israel, but they don't. And why must they condemn Israel? Because of the following: 75 years of illegal occupation, decades of apartheid, decades of ethnic cleansing, tens of thousands of Palestinians murdered, thousands unjustly detained, years of collective punishment, and decades of human rights violations. Now, it is obvious, and I don't like comparing atrocities, but it is obvious that this list that I've mentioned is much worse than the evidence some people are citing to condemn what happened on October the 7th, but stay silent on what Israel has been doing for the past 75 years. Since these people do not also condemn Israel, then it raises a valid suspicion that they are ideologically biased. This should be enough to reframe the narrative. Now, you may argue, well, this list that you mentioned, Hamza, where's the evidence? Don't worry, we're going to be unpacking this when we're talking about the five key points I want to articulate. Now, the second argument, Israel has a right to defend itself, is also false. Consider this. If Israel has a right to defend itself and the killing of 2,000 children is part of that, then logically speaking, does it not somehow justify the attacks that happen in Israel? I'm not saying it's a justification, But logically speaking, the logical door swings both ways. Because if Israel has a right to defend itself, and part of that is killing 2,000 innocent children, then Hamas's actions are justified from that perspective. Because Hamas can argue that their actions are a defense against decades of murder, oppression, apartheid, and illegal occupation. Now, again, I'm not saying this is a justification. I'm merely pointing out the logical implication and contradiction of some of their arguments. Now, obviously, they may respond by saying, there is a big difference, Hamza. Massive difference. Because Hamas targeted children and innocent people specifically. However, sorry, this is not an argument. Because it is clear that Israel is doing the same. And many IDF, Israeli Defense Force members, and Israeli commentators have clearly made that intention. Not just that, when you look at the past 75 years, children have been targeted in cold blood. So they're both the same from this perspective. This is why the massacre in Gaza must stop now. And these two refutations of the two false arguments should be enough to reframe the whole narrative. Now, let's go to the 5 points I want to unpack with you today, the 5 key points. Now, I'm going to summarize them right now, and then I'm going to unpack them with evidence. So the first point is as follows. The conflict did not start on October the 7th, 2023. It has been well established that Israel has been illegally occupying Palestinian land for over 70 years. They have engaged in ethnic cleansing, established an apartheid system, and they have been oppressing Palestinians, Muslim and Christian, for decades, killing innocent civilians, many of which have been children. Point number two. Between 2021 and 2023, over 130 children have been murdered by Israeli forces. Also, hundreds of Palestinian children have been unjustly detained prior to this current conflict, and there has been no outrage from the international community. So the questions are, why the selective outrage, and is a Palestinian child worth less than an Israeli child? Point number three, Gaza has been an open-air prison since 2005. Gaza does not have full control or autonomy. The people of Gaza have been living in conditions that have been described by academics as perverse and degrading. Point number four. Notwithstanding Hamas and Islamic Jihad being proscribed groups in many Western countries, there are many other factions that use their legal right to resist occupying forces. This legal right is well established in international law. Fifth and final point. Commentators have argued that Israel, with regards to its response, is proportionate and justified. This is a ridiculous statement, as they are the oppressors and occupiers. Such arguments can only make sense if you believe the crisis only started on the 7th of October 2023 and you ignore the previous 4 points. So that was a summary. Let's now unpack each point very carefully, citing various pieces of evidence. And by the way, I cannot give you everything because of time, because of practicalities, but hopefully I'm going to give you enough, and I'm going to provide all of these references in the description below. So let's go to the first point. So the first point was about the conflict did not start, or the crisis rather, because to call it a conflict assumes some kind of power symmetry. There is no power symmetry. It's asymmetrical, which is well known. Let's call it a crisis. The crisis did not start on October the 7th, 2023. It has been well established that Israel has been occupying Palestinian land for over 70 years. They have engaged in ethnic cleansing, established an apartheid system, and have been oppressing Palestinians for decades, killing innocent civilians, many of which are children. So let's start first and foremost with Human Rights Watch, which is a well-known international NGO, and they state in their report, a threshold crossed Israeli authorities and the crime of apartheid and persecution. They say the following. About 6.8 million Jewish Israelis and 6.8 million Palestinians live today between the Mediterranean Sea and Jordan River, an area encompassing Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. The latter made up of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip. Throughout most of this area, Israel is the sole governing power In the remainder, it exercised primary authority alongside limited Palestinian self-rule. Across these areas, and in most aspects of life, Israeli authorities methodically privilege Jewish Israelis and discriminate against Palestinians. Laws, policies, and statements by leading Israeli officials make plain that the objective of maintaining Jewish-Israeli control over demographics, political power, and land has long guided government policy. In pursuit of this goal, authorities have dispossessed, confined, forcibly separated, and subjugated Palestinians by virtue of their identity to varying degrees of intensity. In certain areas, as described in this report, these deprivations are so severe, they amount to the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution. And at this stage, I want to refer to you to the Nakba, a word that cannot be used in Israel. Now, the Nakba refers to the Palestinian catastrophe, the disaster, the cataclysm. And this was the destruction of Palestinian society and homeland in 1948. And it was the permanent displacement of a majority of the Palestinian Arabs with no right to return. Essentially, it was the stealing of their land. Now, in summary, the Nakba was basically the expulsion of over 700,000 Palestinians from their homes. It was the burning to the ground of 600 villages, and it was the poisoning of water wells to prevent Palestinians from returning. And this has been echoed by many academics, Jewish and non-Jewish. For example, Jan Selby, Gabriel Daoust, and Clemens Hoffman have written a study published by Cambridge University Press, and they refer to this catastrophe, but not only in 1948, but also 1967, and they summarize it in the following way. They said around 751,000 displaced during the war of 1948 to 1949, a full 88% of the Palestinian population of what would henceforth become Israel. Several hundred thousand more displaced in 1967, over 5 million Palestinians who decades later still have refugee status. Now, before we continue with more evidence, here is a thought experiment to help you further. Imagine London was occupied by France in 1948 and France expelled 700,000 Londoners and they killed tens of thousands of Brits, including women and children, and they enforced a system of apartheid and they enforced persecution for decades. What would be the British response? Now, some would argue it would be far worse than what we've seen in recent years by the Palestinians. Now, considering this, the world should be grateful that the enemies of Zionist Israel are actually the Palestinians. And this thought experiment should be enough to reframe the whole narrative. And this is why, just to echo again, the whole self-defense mantra does not make sense in the context of the historical and political facts. An occupying force is already in an illegal and offensive position. To claim that Israel is defending itself is equivalent to, as Muhammad Hijab put it, a rapist defending themselves from their victim. Now let's cite more evidence. Human Rights Watch again. Now, the Associate Children's Rights Director at Human Rights Watch, Bill Van Esveld, said the following. Israeli forces are gunning down Palestinian children living under occupation with increasing frequency. Unless Israel's allies, particularly the United States, pressure Israel to change course, more Palestinian children will be killed. So this is referring to the killing of Palestinian children, which we're going to unpack in another point as well. Further evidence. Richard Falk, he was the UN Special Rapporteur. In October 2010, he submitted his report to the UN General Assembly. And this is what he said. This is what he stated. It is the opinion of the current Special Rapporteur that the nature of the occupation as of 2010 substantiates early allegations of colonialism and apartheid in evidence and law to a greater extent than was the case even 3 years ago. The entrenching of colonialist and apartheid features of the Israeli occupation has been a cumulative process. The longer it continues, the more difficult it is to overcome, and the more serious is the abridgment of fundamental Palestinian rights. Academics Jay Duggard and Jay Reynolds in 2013 in the academic paper Apartheid, International Law, and the Occupied Palestinian Territory say the following. Overall, more than 40% of the landmass of the West Bank has now been appropriated to make way for Israeli settlement, infrastructure, and is entirely closed to Palestinian use. In March 2012, the UN Committee of the Elimination of Racial Discrimination took the unprecedented step of censuring Israel under the rubric of apartheid and segregation as prohibited by Article 3 of the International Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. On the basis of the systematic and institutionalized nature of the racial domination that exists, there are indeed strong grounds to conclude that a system of apartheid has developed in the occupied Palestinian territory. Israeli practices in the occupied territory are not only reminiscent of, and in some cases worse than, apartheid as it existed in South Africa, but are in breach of the legal prohibition of apartheid. Another NGO, Amnesty International, in 2023, in the report The State of the World's Human Rights, said the following. In Israel and the occupied territories, 2022 saw the system of apartheid solidified. Successive Israeli governments rolled out measures forcing more Palestinians from their homes, expanding illegal settlements, and legalizing existing settlements and outposts across the occupied West Bank. Rather than demand an end to that system of oppression, many Western governments choose instead to attack those denouncing Israel's apartheid system. Many Western governments chose instead to attack those denouncing Israel's apartheid system. Israel maintained an extreme form of discrimination, a system of apartheid, through oppression and domination over Palestinians, through territorial fragmentation, segregation and control, dispossession of land and property, and the denial of economic and social rights. Israel committed a wide range of human rights violations against Palestinians to entrench this system, including forcible transfers, administrative detention, torture, unlawful killings, denial of basic rights and freedoms, and persecution, which constituted the crime against humanity of apartheid. Now, what is more damning is this has come from the mouth of Zionists themselves. Politicians. Zionists have admitted to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians since the 1940s, and it is something they want to continue to do. Take, for instance, investigative journalist Anthony Lowenstein. He writes in his book, The Palestine Laboratory. He says, a rare moment of Israeli political honesty came in October 2021 when far-right Israeli parliamentarian Bezalel Smotrich, leader of the Religious Zionist Party and ally of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said in the Knesset to the Arab members, you are only here by mistake because Ben-Gurion, who by the way was the founding prime minister of the Zionist entity, Ben-Gurion didn't finish the job, didn't throw you out in 48. It was an acknowledgement that ethnic cleansing took place in 1948. And Lowenstein continues, it is not a new point of view, in fact. It's been state ideology since 1948. Declassified documents from the Israeli state archives in 2021 revealed that attitudes towards the Palestinians have not changed much since the 1940s. It has been official policy, at least among some of the nation's senior military and political elites, to forcibly expel Arabs to neighboring countries for the entire period of the country's existence. Reuven Alonai, Deputy Director General of the Israeli Lands Administration, said during a 1965 meeting that the ideal goal was population exchange. He was optimistic, and this is his own words, that a day will come in another 10, 15 or 20 years when there would be a situation of a certain kind with a war or something resembling a war, when the basic solution would be a matter of transferring the Arabs. I think we should think about this as a final goal. And Lowenstein continues, Yehoshua Verbin, commander of the military government that ruled over Arab citizens between 1948 and 1966, admitted that ethnic cleansing occurred in 1948. We expelled around 500,000 Arabs, we burnt homes, we looted their land. From their point of view, we didn't give it back. We took their land, he said. Now that completes the first point, which, to be honest, is enough to reframe the narrative. And I cited various pieces of evidence from NGOs, from academics, from politicians, from investigative journalists, and so on and so forth, to really bring to your attention the illegal occupation, the apartheid, the murder and the killing of Palestinians, and the tyranny and the evils of the Zionist regime. Now let's go to the second point, which focuses on children. Now between 2021 and 2023, prior to the attacks that occurred on the 7th of October, over 130 Palestinian children were murdered by Israeli forces. Also, hundreds of Palestinian children have been unjustly detained prior to this current conflict. And there's been no collective international outrage. Why? So why is there selective outrage? There is a huge outrage with regards to what happened on October the 7th. But prior to that, when it comes to Palestinian lives and children, they've been brutalized and murdered and unjustly detained, which really effectively is basically taking hostages, then where's the collective outrage? Why the asymmetry here? Why have people been, generally speaking, silent on this issue, especially from a mainstream media perspective and the mainstream politicians? Why is there a kind of veiling of the previous historical, political, and social facts on the ground? Why is there a kind of false assumption that the kind of Israeli-Palestinian crisis just started on October the 7th? This deliberate veiling and hiding of these facts and these truths indicates a strong ideological bias. And there's lots of evidence to show that children have been unjustly detained and Palestinian children have been murdered. For example, Human Rights Watch, they said in one of their reports, last year, 2022, was the deadliest year for Palestinian children in the West Bank in 15 years. And 2023 is on track to meet or exceed 2022 levels. Israeli forces had killed at least 34 Palestinian children in the West Bank as of August 22. Now, the West Bank is not even quasi-governed by Hamas, by the way. And you had 34 children being killed by Israeli forces. According to the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, 36 Palestinian children were killed in the West Bank in 2022. So the previous reference is for 2023. This reference is for 2022. So do your math. In 2001, 86 Palestinian children have been killed in the occupied Palestinian territory, according to Defense for Children International. So do your math. It's over 130 children from 2001 to 2023. Also, it is estimated that between 500 and 1,000 children are held in Israeli military detention each year. And all of the references that I'm citing are going to be available in the description below. So from this perspective, where is the international outrage? Where is it? Why the selective sympathy, selective empathy, and selective outrage? Are you saying the life of a Palestinian child is worth less than any other child? Is that what you're saying? These pieces of evidence is enough just to reframe the narrative. Now let's go to the third point. Gaza has been an open-air prison since 2005. Gaza does not have full control or autonomy. Robert Piper wrote in a 2017 UN report the following. And Robert Piper was the UN coordinator for humanitarian aid and development activities in the occupied Palestine territory. He wrote, in 2012, the UN country team produced a report on living conditions in Gaza and predicted that based on the trends we were seeing then, Gaza was on track to become unlivable by 2020. Sadly, as we check in on those same trends again in this 2017 report, the deterioration has accelerated, sped along not least by a devastating round of hostilities in 2014, from which we are only now starting to recover. With electricity only 2 hours a day, as was the case recently, and youth unemployment at 60%, the unlivability threshold has already been passed. Also, in the academic journal that I cited previously, Apartheid International Law and the Occupied Palestinian Territory, Jay Duggard and Jay Reynolds cite the following. Since the removal of Jewish settlers in 2005, Gaza effectively amounts to a besieged Palestinian ghetto with the open-air prison analogy repeatedly invoked. Also, Human Rights Watch, the NGO, they produced this online piece called Gaza, Israel's open-air prison at 15, and they said the following. Israel's sweeping restrictions on leaving Gaza deprive its more than 2 million residents of opportunities to better their lives, Human Rights Watch said today on the 15th anniversary of the 2007 closure. The closure has devastated the economy in Gaza, contributed to fragmentation of the Palestinian people, and forms part of Israeli authorities' crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution against millions of Palestinians. Also consider Jean-Pierre Filiou, the French academic historian Arabist. He has written extensively on religion and politics in the Middle East, and he has written an academic article detailing Israel wars on Palestine. And he had the following to say. Meanwhile, according to a document leaked to Haaretz in October 2012, Israeli decision makers had fixed the average daily intake for the population of Gaza at 2,279 calories per person and were allowing supply trucks into the strip on that basis. The fact that Israel could feel empowered to decide how much a Palestinian could eat on a daily basis shows how perverse and degrading the post-2005 occupation of the Gaza Strip had become. The description of Gaza as an open-air prison was actually far from the mark. Since in any jailhouse, detainees are not supposed to be shot at or bombed except in the case of a full-fledged riot. In Gaza, Israeli raids, whether targeted or not, remain a regular occurrence. Now let's unpack the fourth key point. Notwithstanding Hamas and Islamic Jihad being proscribed groups in many Western countries, there are many other factions that use their legal right to resist occupying forces. This legal right, contrary to many people's opinions, is well established in international law. Take, for example, the UN General Assembly. There are many resolutions that support national liberation movements in the struggle for independence and self-determination, including armed struggle, and take for consideration Resolution 2105 of 1965 and Resolution 2625 of 1970. But I want to zoom in on the UN General Assembly, the 37th session, 1982 to 1983. And I just want to quickly, briefly, just go through three key paragraphs, which really emphasizes the point that we're trying to make. Considering the denial of the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, sovereignty, independence, and return to Palestine, and the repeated acts of aggression by Israel against the peoples of the region constitute a serious threat to international peace and security. They also say, reaffirming the importance of the universal realization of the right of peoples to self-determination, national sovereignty, and territorial integrity, and of the speedy granting of independence to colonial countries and peoples as imperatives for the full enjoyment of all human rights. And significantly, they mention this. Reaffirms the legitimacy of the struggle of peoples for independence, territorial integrity, national unity, and liberation from colonial and foreign domination and from foreign occupation by all available means, including armed struggle. We also have the Geneva Conventions. In accordance with international humanitarian law, wars of national liberation have been expressively embraced through the adoption of additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions of 1949 as a protected and essential right of occupied people everywhere. And this includes occupied Palestine. They have this right for wars of national liberation. So from this perspective, other factions that are not described as terrorist groups by Western governments exist in Palestine, and they have the right, according to international law, to resist occupation. And this point also helps reframe the narrative. Now let's unpack the fifth and final point. Is Israel's response proportionate and justified? Now, I believe the previous thought experiments and the previous points that I've mentioned already answered this question. But I want to emphasize the obvious answer with a thought experiment. Now, imagine your neighbor occupied your home and your village with his immediate and extended family. He killed your children and detained your wife. He remained there for years and degraded and abused you and all the villagers. And he regularly, on a weekly basis, killed the children of the village. Suddenly, in response, in defense maybe, one would argue, you attack and kill your neighbor's family. Soon after, your neighbor fights back by killing more members of your family, the villagers, and destroys the homes of the population. Now, would your neighbor's response be considered proportionate and justified? Now remember, this is not about targeting innocent people. We're not justifying that. But in the context of this thought experiment and applying it to what you now know about the Palestinian crisis, is Israel's response proportionate and justified? This thought experiment is designed to help you reframe the narrative and to see who and what is the real cause of this crisis. Now let's remember, my dear brothers and sisters, since October the 7th, 2023, Israel has killed over 4,000 Palestinians, approximately 2,000 children have been murdered, and Israel has injured over 13,000 people, and they've destroyed over 11,000 buildings and permanently displaced over 100,000 people. This is disproportionate. This is genocide, and it must stop now. In conclusion, my dear brothers and sisters and friends, in the context of the thought experiments and the five key points that I unpacked, and in the context of decades of illegal occupation, decades of apartheid, decades of oppression, decades of killing children, decades of illegal detainment of children, decades of systematic persecution, the current conflict, or rather, the current crisis should be understood as Israel being the oppressor, Israel being the occupier, Israel being the tyrant. And for peace to happen, and we all want peace, Israel must stop illegally occupying land and persecuting the Palestinian people. They must stop persecuting the Palestinian people. And the apartheid must be dismantled, just like what happened in South Africa. Because you cannot have peace and justice coexisting with apartheid. It's impossible. The apartheid system of Zionist Israel must be dismantled. Now, this does not mean, of course, that we want Jewish people to be expelled. Of course not. As a Muslim, we believe that we need to protect all human beings and take care of all human beings and be committed to their well-being, to the goodness and guidance, including Jewish people. And this is what happened in Islamic history anyway. For example, the popular historian Karen Armstrong, she says for the very first time, Jews, Christians, and Muslims live peacefully in Jerusalem. She says the Muslims had established a system that enabled Jews, Christians, and Muslims to live in Jerusalem together for the first time. So everything that happens in this current crisis, my dear brothers, sisters, and friends, must be understood in the context of the thought experiments I raised and the five key points I unpacked. the crisis must be understood in the context of illegal occupation, decades of persecution, decades of ethnic cleansing. It has to be understood in that context. And that's why people of conscience have a responsibility to learn about the necessary social, historical, and political context. Otherwise, if we don't consider what has been mentioned thus far, we will never have peace, and we will be promoting, inadvertently or advertently, genocide enablers, ethnic cleansing apologists, and apartheid promoters. And this would mean that you'll have blood on your hands.